everyone. I'm Gary Naughan. I'd like to welcome you to this program. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Of the 15 hours of broadcasting live each week that I do, this is the one that takes on a serious single issue with one or more guests, and we probe the issue and then open it up for comments and feedback from the audience. Today, our issue on a topic in post-election is, what reasonably can we expect happening from the choices that were made by the electorate? My guest to share insights is Gerald Celante. He is one of today's pioneers in trend strategy. He founded the Trends Research Institute in Kingston, New York, and is the publisher of the highly respected Trends Journal that's been going to people since 1980. He is also a diagnostician of the human condition. He has been ahead of the curve predicting major events, including the economic crisis that we've been facing. His website is trendsresearch.com. That's trendresearch.com. Nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Gary.
Gerald, we're going to begin by first reporting on something that I think is essential and that caught my eye last evening when I was flying back from a series of lectures. I did four lectures yesterday as a fundraiser for our sister station, WPFW in Washington, D.C. And I was reading The Nation magazine, and inside the cover, they have their editorial, which is written and inputted by many of their staff, and it says a progressive surge. That's the title. I'll just read the first sentence. A country reeling from one disaster has dodged another. While President Obama's reelection inspires varying degrees of hope among progressives, it has evoked one common sentiment, relief. Democracy may not be reborn, but a living symbol, a plutocracy, was defeated by the voters. And then it goes on to talk glowingly about what this means for the Democrats and those who supported Obama, and what it means as a statement against of the Republicans. It also says that the Senate's, quote, newly invigorated progressive caucus provides Majority Leader Harry Reid with an opening to respond to pressure for reform of Senate rules. And they also say that Nancy Pelosi is progressive, Harry Reid's progressive. I don't see that any of these individuals are progressive. So here's what I'm going to do. I have made a little commentary that will only take a few moments, offering a constructive challenge, nothing demeaning, to the nation. It's done a lot of good work over the years. It has a lot of very important thinkers. But on this issue, I believe that their unbridled support of Obama is more in alignment with the talking heads of Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell and Ed Schultz and the other persons on MSNBC. And you'll find them also on a lot of the liberal radio stations, including one of our sister stations, BAI New York and KPFK in Los Angeles. Which is certainly their right, and I'm not challenging that. But here is how I'm looking at it. First, I'm going to take two issues. The quote that I would challenge most is from The Nation. They say, "We are glad the 1% were rebuffed at the polls," end quote. I would like to remind them that President Obama's main supporters on Wall Street were the 1%. In corporate America, the 1%, the energy cartels, Big Agra, the insurance industry, the for-profit hospital associations, the military-industrial contractors, all were 1%er. The giant hedge funds and equity partnerships that he had fundraising dinners in their homes, the 1%. If anything, virtually everything that Obama has done through his mandates, executive orders, support the 1% and not support the 99%. Also, in the article, there was a statement about how Elizabeth Warren's win in Massachusetts is an endorsement for Obama. I would offer a different perspective. I would say her platform since leaving the White House has clearly been opposed to everything Obama's inner economic circle, like Timothy Geithner and the Rubenites, believe in. Also, to associate in any way, Sherrod Brown's win in Ohio, who is a staunch labor supporter and utterly different to Obama's free trade ideology of continued support for NAFTA, union bashing, and outsourcing of American factories and jobs, which were accelerated under Obama, and at no point actually stopped or challenged. At no time in Obama's first 4 years did he go on television, as FDR used to have his evening fireside chats, where he communicated directly with the American public, and did Obama say, "Let us examine the outcome and the results of all these treaties, NAFTA and GATT and CAFTA and the new Trans-Pacific Partnership. These are all meant to allow corporations and multinational neoliberal trading associations to virtually take all the resources, privatize water and electricity and roads and docks, everything from any country that we can exploit, including the United States. We're going to make their laws supreme over any American law. And we're going to make sure that all American companies and employees fall into alignment or they will be penalized and put out of business." That's the truth of every single law he has passed on trades, as had Clinton before him. These are both very staunch corporate Democrats. And also, with the addition of Warren and Brown and also Tammy Baldwin from Minnesota, the Senate has a few progressives, but it's a far cry from the truth to call the Democratic majority in the Senate a progressive base. It is not. The Nation magazine's putting Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi in the camp of progressives, that is simply uncharacteristically wrong. They have never in their careers been progressive. They are really good quality, rank and file corporate Democrats. And yes, Alan Grayson is a true progressive in the tradition of, let's say, Dennis Kucinich or Bernie Sanders or Ralph Nader or Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson. But the nation's blind worship of Obama is a challenge because they're not acknowledging these are liberals and not progressives. Also, here is what we can expect in the next 4 years. It said, quote, the article was apologetic on Obama, quote, at least acknowledging the need to act on global warming on election night. I'm sorry, President Obama has not done a single thing to curb the U.S. carbon footprint. To the contrary, President Obama will do more to pollute our environment, do more to open up the national open lands, the lands we hold in common, the oceans we have in common, than any president in American history. He favors and will support fully the pipeline, astronomically increasing gas hydrofracking, opening up our national preserves for oil and gas excavation, proposing our own tar sand operations in Utah, and continuing to believe in the myth of clean coal. He wants to expand by 24 our nuclear power plants. So that is why I'm challenging the Nation magazine. Now to conclude this, Jill, before we come to you, I just went back and carefully and methodically and with full scholarship, no personal bias, I examined his record. What did he promise and what did he deliver? Here is what he promised and did not deliver. Expanding the Child Independent Care Credit. Credit a foreclosure prevention fund for homeowners. Obama created a fund, but he failed to make it meet the benchmarks for helping actual homeowners. The Inspector General deemed the program, quote, a colossal failure. To create a mortgage interest tax for non-itemizers. To create a retirement savings tax credit for low-incomers. To end the income tax for seniors making less than $50,000, to end no-bid contracts over $25,000, to create a $60 billion bank to fund roads and bridges and our infrastructures, to repeal the Bush tax credits for higher incomes, to sign the Employee Free Choice Act, making it easier for workers to unionize, to forbid companies in bankruptcy from giving executives bonuses, to allow imported prescription drugs, to prevent drug companies from blocking generic drugs at a tiny fraction of the price of what the federal government is having to pay through Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA, to allow Medicare to negotiate for cheaper drugs, direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services to conduct an honest, independent, comprehensive study of all of our federal cancer initiatives, all of which have failed. We've had a 43-year failed war on cancer and still continue to believe that funding it with hundreds of billions of dollars is the right thing to do, and they have nothing to show for it. To fully fund the Individuals with Disability Education Act, to require employers to provide 7 paid sick days per year, to reduce Veteran Benefits Administration's claims backlog. Currently, there are 400,000 claims pending within the Veterans Benefit Administration, and over 800,000 claim receipts are expected in just the next year, and they are completely in chaos. To form international groups to help Iraq refugees, to work with Russia to move nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert, to clarify legal status for defense contractor personnel, to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, to secure ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, to seek independent watchdog agencies to investigate congressional ethics violations, to expose special interest tax breaks to public scrutiny, to allow 5 days of public comment before signing bills, tougher rules against revolving door for lobbyists and former officials, double funding for after-school programs, allow bankruptcy judges to modify terms of a home mortgage, to increase the supply of affordable housing throughout the metropolitan regions, to increase the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour, to restore the Superfund programs so that polluters pay for cleanups, support tax deductions for artists, strengthen the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, and require 25% renewable energy by 2025. Require plug-in fleet of hybrid cars for all government vehicles. Require energy conservation in use of transportation dollars. Sign the Freedom of Choice Act. What did he say? Quote, throughout my career, I've been a consistent, strong supporter of reproductive justice and have consistently had a 100% pro-choice rating with Planned Parenthood, and I will be continuing to defend the right of passing the Freedom of Choice Act as president. Recognize the Armenian genocide. What did he say? Quote, 2 years ago, I criticized the Secretary of State for firing a U.S. ambassador to Armenia, John Evans, after he properly used the term genocide to describe Turkey's slaughter of thousands of Armenians starting in 1915. As president, I will recognize the Armenian genocide, end quote. He does not and will not, because of his alignment with Turkey, to create a public option health plan for a new national health insurance exchange. He said, quote, the exchange will require that all the plans offered are at least as generous as the new public plan and meet the same standards of quality and efficiency, end quote. He did not do anything. Cut the cost of the typical family's health insurance premium by $2,500 a year, and finally introduce a comprehensive immigration bill in the first year. Now, mind you, those are not all, but that gives you an idea of what he has promised and has not delivered on. But what he has delivered on is he has given us more signing statements and more executive orders. He has gone after all the whistleblowers more than all the presidents in history combined. He has done more to kill more people, innocent civilians, over 1,000 with drones, and taken no responsibility. And he has ensured that the military-industrial complex has more power and over everything and everyone. So, and that is just my concern. Now, why the nation would support him, why Democrats and liberals would support him, is for each to decide for themselves. And my final thought is this. What was left out of this entire dialogue was the idea that there are now more than 90 million Americans who are registered voters who chose not to vote. That's 90 90 million people who said, I will not vote in this election. We believe that a lot of those individuals are uniquely independent and refuse to vote for the lesser of two evils. We also believe many of those are progressives. Now, when you look at the 1,178,000 votes that Gary Johnson got as a libertarian, and 414,000 of Jill Stein, and even the Constitutionalist Party, Mr. Good, got 113,000, and Roseanne Barr got 49,000. The lowest was Rocky Anderson with 35,000. That's still a small beginning. And then they deem any third-party effort ridiculous. Today, The Nation magazine, quote, delusions of a third-party candidates by Ben Adler. And he attacked Ralph Nader, and he attacked any effort just to have a third party, ridiculed it, mocked it, denigrated it, called it, it was calling it all forms of names. It didn't just take a different position, and that's unfortunate, because they're saying we should only have a two-party system. This is The Nation magazine. Oliver Hall from Washington, D.C., challenged them today. Ben Adler was one who wrote Delusions of a Third-Party Candidates. Well, Ben Adler, are you aware there are 90 million Americans who didn't like your party or the Republican Party, and that they represent a higher majority than either of your Democrat or Republicans, twice as large as either of yours? Those are my concerns. I would like you now to take your time, since I've laid out our argument for the program, and go through what you see as the validity of another Obama presidency. I'm particularly interested in what your feelings are about starting a People's Party, taking all of the 90 million people who are fed up and discouraged and bringing them into the fold. Is this realistic or not? Do you believe we could have legitimate coalitions or not? The forum is yours, Gerald.
Well, first of all, you summarized everything, you know, almost perfectly, all the Obama backtracks, and I've come up with a slogan, not a slogan, but a line, and that is that conservatives believe and liberals lie. Conservatives believe their trip. You know, we got to kill the Muslims over there before they come over here. I mean, they actually believe this nonsense and other things, warmonging things, and ridiculous racist beliefs. Liberals, on the other hand, particularly those with The Nation and those other erudite liberals who are intelligent enough to know better, they lie. Every time you go through the list of Obama backtracks, as you did, they'll make up an excuse for them. And of course, you left out, you know, a couple of them, even though you went through the whole long list of them. How about when he was going to clean up Washington and bring in a new team? And what does he do? He retains the Bush-appointed Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense and brought in Cold Warrior James L. Jones, the former Marine General and NATO commander, to head the National Security Administration. And it's one after another. He brought in the old Clinton team, and there was no change you could believe in. He did not, as he had his lofty promise, heal the nation and repair the world. I'm not making that up. He said that. And the liberals buy into it. And then, of course, there was the Patriot Act, which he's made worse than it was before, along with warrantless wiretapping. And I'm sure those liberals, those Obama apologists, love that their man sent in the Solicitor General to fight and argue for the strip search law that the Supreme Court passed. That's right, if you get caught having one drink too many, or your bicycle doesn't have a bell on it, and you badmouth a cop and you get thrown into jail, bend over and spread your legs. Anyone that gets arrested for any reason that's put in jail, they can now get strip searched. I'm sure that's right up those now that's progressive for you. And then you keep going down the list. And then there was, when he was running in 2008, how he promised those folks, he always uses the word folks, he promised those folks in Michigan and Ohio and the other Rust Belt areas, that he was going to look into NAFTA and talk about repealing it and making it more fair. And of course, he did nothing. And then, of course, there's also the transparency issue. This government has been as non-transparent as the Bush administration and the Clinton one before that, and on and on. And then, of course, there was the wonderful National Defense Authorization Act. Every liberal loves that one. Oh, you know the one where the Obama could sign off and say anybody or anybody they don't like is an enemy of the state, has ties to Al-Qaeda and those other terrorists, and no judge, no jury, no trial, not even any charges, and the military could come and take you away and blow your brains out. And of course, there was that also rendition issue, which is still going on. Don't torture them over here, torture them over there. All wonderful, wonderful, wonderful fascist, progressive, according to the Nation, actions. And of course, let's not forget the great bailouts. And this is, to me, one of the great issues of the day. There's no discussion here. There's nothing, you know, that anybody has to think deeply about. Private banks made bad bets, and we had to bail them out under the big lie that if the private banks failed, then we would all fail with them. So where's the Obama administration going? It's taking us into a black hole that I've never seen before in my life. And it's because of the liberals that lie. They're intelligent enough to know better, but they're the pseudo-left. That's all they are. Has anybody looked at where all the money has gone? And you picked up, of course, who supported his candidacy and where most of the money came from. Has the middle class done better or worse under Obama? Oh, give him a chance. And how about the lovely war for the Nobel Peace Prize winner? What a beautiful job they did with that humanitarian mission in Libya. That's now spreading into northern Africa, and now they're talking about teaming up with the Algerians to go fight in Mali. Oh, and of course, we have to take out Assad, don't we? So, yeah, this is all perfect liberal progressive. These people are the biggest hypocrites walking the planet. And whether it's the Quran or the Bible, Jesus, Muhammad, or Buddha, there is no salvation for the hypocrites. And that's all the Nation is. It's filled with hypocritical facts that they keep covering up. Where's the Nation going? $1 trillion has been lost in the equity markets since Obama won the election a few days ago. That's where it's going. And I'm pleased that Obama won for the single reason, and the single reason only, is that if Romney won, the same stupid people from the different side would have said, oh, give him a chance. You know, he was a businessman. He has some plans. Now this whole thing will unravel a lot quicker, and the charade could be shown for what it is. So that's why I'm glad Obama won. It was a race between an empty suit and a stuffed shirt, and the empty suit won.
I appreciate the insight. Now I want to go to some specifics that I believe that the American media has intentionally not covered. I'm going to quote from Global Research from Comenigan O. Croindahine. It's called Ireland's Booming Economy in the Midst of Austerity Cutbacks. It's short, but it's so important to see what is going to be happening in Europe. You and I talked about this, Gerald, over 2 years ago, then a year ago, and I believe that it's all coming to be. Here's what he says. Despite the fact that the Irish people are currently enduring endless austerities and cutbacks, the exports are booming. The Irish Export Association reports a 10% rise in the export of goods and services in Ireland between July and September compared to the same time a year ago. And it says, meanwhile, the Irish government is handing out a large percentage of the budget to unsecured bondholders to the tune of $18 billion this year, with a couple of billion more to go before the year's end. Quote, please know we are being betrayed by our own. We are betrayed by our own government, who are colluding with the European Central Bank and implementing a policy of private interest over public good, of the primacy of banks over people. We are betrayed by a national media who have abandoned their primary duty of objectively and honestly informing the people of what's happening, end quote. However, the media has been busy reporting on things that are not important. So what we have in Ireland today, according to this article, is that there's great suffering on part of the average person, even school teachers, when the government's finances is deteriorating. In the area of education and health and working conditions and cutbacks are having demoralizing effects on society as a whole. For example, the Teachers Union of Ireland commissioned a new independent survey which showed, quote, the massive impact that cutbacks have had on schools all over the country, in particular the loss of posts of responsibility such as year ahead have severely damaged the support framework so important for marginalizing students, end quote, and reducing family incomes have had a significant detrimental impact on students. The capacity of schools to buy books, they can't, and to have what they need, they don't have it. There's a great problem here. Quote, we have hit rock bottom. I've been working in other countries such as Iran and Saudi Arabia, but conditions are far worse here, and doctors, both national and from overseas, are on the verge of nervous breakdowns. Things are at a crisis point, end quote. And yet, the business and political elites are determined to make ordinary Irish people pay for the financial crisis with a whole raft of new taxes and charges coming down the line over this coming year. And, for example, property taxes are going up. Water taxes are going up. Quote, we have a tsunami of mortgage arrears. 23% of all the mortgages in Ireland are behind. 23%. Now, what does that mean? Gerald, take a look. We predicted that first all the governments of the European Union, 27 governments, 17 using their currency, all of them would agree to support any country in crisis, especially southern countries, with the exception of Ireland and England, but Greece and also Spain and Italy and Portugal, that give them money. But that money never made it to the people. It never made it into their institutions. It went to the bondholders. It went to the banks. Now all this money, when we say, oh, there's going to be $100 billion given to Greece to pay its debt, that's going right back to the banks, not to the people. Instead, in Greece, I said first they will throw out the politicians. Then they will refuse to pay back this money, much like Iceland did. And then there will be absolute civil war in Greece. But now I see that civil war can happen where the people throw out their government, close down the banks as we know it by closing down the debt, and taking back the sovereignty on the part of the people, much like the Icelanders did. And I see this coming in the next 24 months all over Europe, just completely destroying the European Union as we know it. And then that could be something that then happens here, because the same austerity programs that they're suffering from, lowering wages, more taxes, more burden, stopping public infrastructure, putting new lights where street lights gone up, picking up garbage, all this is going to happen in the United States. Give us your blueprint of what you see happening in Europe and then happening in the United States.
Well, as I said, the first great war of the 21st century has begun. There was never an Arab Spring. It's the same thing everywhere. Far too few have much too much, and way too many have much too little. And it's as old as, you know, modern history that we know about, and that's class warfare. And we wrote about this long before it happened. We came out in the Trends Journal in 2010. We called it Off With Their Heads 2.0. And so what you're talking about are the millions of people, the indignados, taking to the streets in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, in Italy. Look at the five-star movement, Beppe Grillo's movement. And that's they've become the number two party now in Italy. And what you're looking at is as I said, this is outright thievery. They're taking the money. The banks and the creditors knew the risks that they were taking. and they lost. You want to call it capitalism? No, it's not capitalism anymore. Not when you bail out the too rich to fail. And that's all this has been. I just got back from Dublin. I was in Munich and Dublin. I went to Dublin to talk to a group that is pushing for direct democracy, and they're serious about it. Let the people vote, like they do in Switzerland. And when I was in Ireland last week, the breaking news was this. One of the guys that was mostly a government agent, you know, an overseer, and part of the whole corruption in one of the banks that the people had to bail out. I forgot what the number is, something like 20 billion. You know, just remember, Ireland's a country of only 4.5 million people. This guy's getting a 500,000 pound, excuse me, euro, 500,000 euro a year severance pay. 500,000 for screwing things up. And then when they pushed the government, the Kenny government, they said, well, that, you know, we don't have any legal authority over that. So in other words, the people have had it. Everywhere you look now, and I was in Ireland a year and a half ago, and I couldn't believe the change, and they were in bad shape then, what it is now. Everywhere you look, and I'm talking in downtown, any place, to let and for sale. Everywhere you look, incomplete buildings, cranes still there with nothing going on. The people have had it, and they're taking it into their own hands with direct democracy. Let the people vote. So what we're looking at, and I've made this very clear, history is repeating itself. The crash of 1929, the Great Depression, currency wars, trade wars, world war. The panic of 08, the Great Depression, it's on. Currency wars are on. They're going on now, listening to Guido Mantega, he's the finance minister of Brazil. Quote, a currency war has begun. They have devalued the dollar and continue to do it. Same thing with the euro, by all of these historically low interest rates that prohibit people from saving money but debase the currency. It allows exporters to sell their stuff overseas, and the stronger economies can't compete because their currency is worth more. Trade wars. You heard Obama and Romney talk about trade wars with China. China also, look what's going on between China and Japan over these so-called disputed islands. And also, pick up the newspapers and read all about it, how the United States is now increasing its presence in Asia and the South Pacific. So here's the scenario. The next thing is the Great War. When all else fails, they take you to war. We're watching war unfold in front of our eyes. I talked about Europe. We talk about Tunisia. We could talk about Egypt. How about what's going on in Bahrain? As I mentioned earlier, Mali and much of Africa, look at the strikes going on throughout South Africa with the miners, whether it's in diamonds or platinum or gold. Look what's going on. There's a civil war in Bahrain, but you can't say anything bad about Bahrain because the United States has the Fifth Fleet there, and emirs and kings aren't dictators or autocrats. We all know from as little children that kings are good, dictators are bad. So you're seeing destabilization. Yemen is up for grabs. Now you're seeing also unrest spread to, oh, I forgot the wonderful civil war going on because of the so-called Arab League supporting an overthrow of Assad with the United States and NATO behind it, and the destabilization and the civil war raging in Libya. How many more wars have to flare up? How many more millions of people have to take to the streets before they call a spade a spade? And this spade is war.
Do you believe that with China having the power to influence with seven other nations, according to last week, a trading in their own currency, the Chinese currency, including with South Korea and with Indonesia, that's the harbinger, that is the clarion call, that it's only a matter of time before they displace the dollar as the reserve currency? That's number one. What will that, if it does do that, what will that do to the value of our dollars and our inflationary level? And secondly, China is poised right now, as we speak, with the United States having over $16 trillion in federal debt, and the Treasury Department estimates that our debt to China is approximately $1.16 trillion, and currently there is $4.3 trillion owed to countries like China, Japan, and the United Kingdom, and China owns roughly 27% of this total, and China's rich in gold, the largest producer and holder of gold in the world. What do you see this doing when China becomes the number one economic power in the world, which will happen within the next 4 years or sooner? Will we then continue to be able to borrow money from them? Will we then continue to posture by building bases and getting alliances against them in the Pacific, like with Australia and New Zealand, some other countries? Will China any longer tolerate us and our actions, knowing that they are the world's leading economy in just another year or two, knowing that they have money we do not, we have debt that they do not, and that they have relationships with other countries we do not? What will this mean when no one is paying attention to the power of China compared to the historical power of the United States, which is about to have a rude awakening?
Well, before I answer that, is one quick note. I was talking about the wars. How could I forget Iran? And when you're looking at Iran, NATO has already declared war against them. It's economic warfare. So, in moving on to your question, as goes the United States and Europe, so goes China. Europe, until 4 years ago, was China's biggest importer. Now the United States is, because of the Depression racking much of Europe. If the United States and China don't make a buy product, China doesn't make it. China is also, as we speak, they've lowered interest rates twice in the last month, and they're dumping trillions of yuan into the country in order to keep it going. They're facing a housing bubble as well, and as you well pointed out, they're holding trillions of dollars of U.S. treasuries that are being devalued in front of their eyes. If China's not making goods, or Indonesia or India, and India, of course, is in the midst of a great corruption scandal, and this is what it's all about in all countries, corruption only has different names and faces, they're not making product either. Either is Vietnam, either is Bangladesh, and the other cheap labor countries. If they're not making, then Canada, Australia, Bolivia, Chile, Brazil, all of the natural resource countries, they're not exporting product. And in Australia, one of the biggest exporters to China, the minister over there, the commerce minister, let it slip out that the commodities boom is over. I don't believe China, although China will become the world's largest economy in 4 years, they have a billion plus people and a million problems, and they're going to be suffering from them too. This is a global meltdown as I see it. Will there be a reserve currency as the dollar continues to get devalued? Yes, I believe there will be. And you're already seeing it with the BRIC nations as well. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But again, that's only going to happen if there isn't a complete economic meltdown, which it looks like is happening. Here's my belief in the new currency. I think there will be a new world currency, and I think it's going to be a basket of currencies, with the yuan, the yen, the euro, and possibly, and the dollar. Something of that nature, with gold also as part of a standard of it. No one country is going to be able to go it alone anymore. And what everyone should understand, and we're all, anybody out there that's old enough to know, we have never seen in our lifetimes interest rates at the rates that they're at now. I just got a commercial loan at 3.25% for 10 years. They're already promising to keep interest rates low through mid-2015. What this means is that in the old days, once upon a time, people used to put money away and save it. No more. You put your money away, you don't get any interest on it. It's not worth putting it in a bank. What this means is it's a debasement of the currency. And here's what I believe will happen. I believe there's going to be war, false flag or real. People call this Veterans Day. I don't. The last veterans that weren't shafted were World War II and before. I call this Victims Day for the fake wars that the psychopathic presidents have started and sent our troops to get slaughtered. The Korean War that Eisenhower was man enough to stop, that he didn't start. The Vietnam War that took 58,000 of our troops. The Iraq and Afghanistan War, all three of those, four of those fought for fake reasons. The Vietnam Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened the way they reported it. There were no weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. All the news is about this General Petraeus who got caught having an extramarital affair. How about bringing the guy, how about breaking his rank for telling us the years of the impressive progress that was being made in Afghanistan? Those are his words. So what I'm saying, Gary, is that when all else fails, they take you to war and they do it very easily and they lie us into war. When that happens, there's going to be an excuse, as they've done before, to call a bank holiday or something to debase the currency. That's what they did in 1933. It was called the Federal Emergency Banking Act. And what they did in those days, gold was pegged to the dollar. And gold was pegged to the dollar, I believe it was like something like $20.62 an ounce, or thereabouts. They made everyone turn in their gold. If you didn't, you'd get 10 years in jail and double the fine of what you had in gold. After they got the gold in, they re-pegged the price of gold to the dollar at $35 to an ounce of gold. That meant that you lost 70% of your purchasing power. That's what I see happening. A steady debasement of the currency. That's the only thing they're going to do in order to get out of this, because, let's face it, how are they going to get out of a $16 trillion-plus debt and racking up $1 trillion a year in budget deficits? They're not.
Okay, I'm going to need some short answers now. Do you believe that we know that almost immediately in office, if Romney had won, that Netanyahu and his Likud and party would have controlled the Knesset and caused war with Iran? Now that Obama's got another tenure here for 4 years, do you see Israel attacking Iran? If it does, we know that China, Russia, India are all going to align themselves, not militarily, but economically and with trade and currency exchange with Iran. What will happen with our relationships if we have to go in there and support Israel? What do you see happening to gas in the United States? What do you see happening to our relationships with the rest of the world? Because this will not be the same kind of effort we had in Iraq. Iran is much larger, enormous, double the population, double the size, even larger than twice the size of Iraq, and they are prepared. They've been expecting this to happen. What is the likely outcome? Give us your concise answer, please.
World War III. These are the Persians. As you pointed out, there are 70 million of them. Everything I said, forget about what you have or what you want. Life won't be worth living. It'll be, you know how they say the generals keep fighting the last war? This won't be fought with F-35s that cost $1 trillion. This will be fought with weapons of mass destruction, suitcase-sized nukes, biological warfare, dirty bombs. In 2000, I was called to VMI, Virginia Military Institute. I had written Trends 2000 several years earlier to talk about new millennium warfare. General Zinni and other generals were on the panel after I spoke. And this is what I said back then, and I'm saying it again now. That's the kind of war that you're going to see. It'll be hell. If Iran is attacked by Israel and the United States gets involved in it, forget about China, Russia, India supporting them, friends or no friends, it will be World War III.
Okay. I can't imagine that they haven't been planning and having multiple secret exercises and have cells around. I bet they're going to go after Saudi Arabia, their mortal enemy. And one's Iran is Shia, Saudi Arabia is Sunni, and they're going to disrupt their oil flow, which will cause 60% of the world's oil to simply cease its normal production and route out of the country. And imagine what this is going to do to Americans.
That's what I said. I mean, look how ill prepared this country was for the hurricane. Could you imagine? My God. Could you imagine what would happen if a dirty bomb went off? If a nuclear power plant was attacked? I mean, that's what I'm saying. It will turn into hell. And okay. The psychopaths in charge will lead us there.
Now, here's my last issue with you. This is from today's New York Times. It's from Tamara Lewin. Child education, but the parents crushing loans. I'll quote the first paragraph here. When Michelle Fitzgerald and her daughter, Jenny, go out for dinner, Jenny pays. When they get haircuts, Jenny pays. When they buy grocery, Jenny pays. It has been 6 years since Miss Fitzgerald broke, unemployed, and in default on the $18,000 in loans she took out for Jenny's college education, became a boomerang mom, moving her into her daughter's own townhouse apartment in Henningham, Massachusetts. Jenny pays the rent. And then it goes on to talk about what is happening. By the way, this is happening to millions. That's on the outside front page. This is on the inside. Suzanne Daly, wave of evictions leads to homelessness crisis in Spain. Quote from Seville, Spain. The first night after Francisco Rodriguez Flores, 71, and his wife, Ana Lopez Corral, 67, were evicted from their small apartment here after falling behind on their mortgage. They slept in the entrance hall of their building. Their daughters, both unemployed and living with them, slept in a neighbor's van. Quote, it was the worst thing ever, Miss Lopez said recently, studying her hands. You can't imagine what it felt like to be there in that hallway. It's a story you can't really tell because it's not the same as living it. Now, all across Europe and all across the United States, individuals who once had employment, a home, a family, the rituals of social environment, all have been turned upside down. The President of the United States has refused to go to the aid of the public by demanding a moratorium on all mortgage foreclosures, to stop the banks. We could forgive all those interest loans, all interest on all loans. We could allow students who can't pay to declare bankruptcy. We could allow people to have their mortgages brought to the level of the actual value of the home. All that's doable because we give trillions of dollars to the banks that control these people's debit cards, credit cards, student loans, and mortgages, and car payments. We choose not to, and as a nation, those who voted Obama back in office and those who voted for Romney, together, that part of the electorate refuses to acknowledge that the government and these corporations who've been stealing from us and manipulating us for decades should give back all that interest and stop this. They choose not to. What do you see happening now in the United States for the working class, the middle class, the poorer class in the next 4 years?
It's going to get much worse. I mean, why should it get any better? Oh, because and then there's that fiscal cliff. The inepts and the incompetents that couldn't fix it for over a year and a half are going to fix it now. You know, Neil Barofsky wrote a wonderful book, Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. And this is a guy that was put in charge of monitoring TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, as they called it. And he blew the whistle on Obama's big lie about how that bank rescue program was supposed to help the people. And I remember the day it was announced when Henry Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs and U.S. Treasury Secretary at the time, said they were doing this to help the people so they wouldn't lose their house. And as it was as well pointed out in Barofsky's book, they didn't hardly any money went back to the people, and the people ended up losing their homes. Here's what I believe. I believe it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace that they call this country the United States of America, when people who've worked all their lives can no longer afford, not for any fault of their own, to pay school or property taxes, are evicted out of their homes by so-called government officials, and their homes are taken back by the banks that we bailed out. It's a disgrace, the people that are being put out on the street. And when you read more into those stories about the people that are losing their homes and losing their lives, you know my saying, when people lose everything and have nothing left to lose, they lose it. And what they're doing is they're committing suicide. They're committing violent acts. The people are in desperation. And what do? They all cheer like the little Obama-apologists from the progressive nation. Progressive, it could not be more regressive.
Final thoughts. We have 2 minutes, 3 minutes to go, Gerald. When I travel the country now, I'm seeing what I have never seen before in my lifetime, and I've done a great deal of traveling. I'm seeing cities that have nice little areas and beautiful areas, and then I'm seeing in the larger urban area and then in the suburbs, I'm seeing gangs, areas that I'm told don't drive there, don't go there, street lights that are out, garbage that's piling up, roads that are potholed, police forces eviscerated, fire departments cut back, schools closed, teachers laid off. I'm seeing this everywhere in the United States. How far can we go before the average American stands up and says no more? Or will we stand up? Are we even capable of it at this point?
And who are the we? You know, and the we's, you know, you're doing it, I'm doing my best, and a number of people I know are as well. And until people get the courage, the dignity, the self-respect, and the integrity to create their own future rather than letting these other people create it for them, it's going to continue to decline. I'm telling you, when I went to Dublin, and the people there, just regular working people, they've had it. They're forming direct democracy movements, and they're gaining strength. But the people here, just by that disgusting article that you read from The Nation, you know, they're still buying into the baloney. So, no, they're going to keep denying it. I don't think we're going to see the kind of movement in this country until the young people really get it together, because our generation, you know, they don't have the fight left of them. They're out of shape, and they're bankrupt emotionally and spiritually and often financially. It has to come from the young people. If it doesn't come from them, it's not going to happen. And when I'm saying young, I'm saying, you know, 40-something and under. Those are the ones that can make the change happen.
Okay, Gerald, thank you for sharing your insights with us on this Progressive Commentary Hour. Gerald Celente, C-E-L-E-N-T-E, publication The Trends Journal, published 4 times a year, at a website, trendresearch.com. All the best to you, Gerald, and to our next discussion. I'm Gary Nall, and those are some postscripts on this election and what I consider to be an open offer to The Nation magazine to reevaluate their statements about what is going on and how they see the world versus how so many others do. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.